Our text is not that long, so you may want to keep your Bibles with you because obviously we'll need to go other places to fill in what is being communicated in this serious, dark, and yet grace-enabling command. He says in verse 13, "You shall not murder." The 20th century was by far one of the bloodiest centuries our world has ever known. Historians approximate 125 million lives lost. That's probably a low number. Two world wars. World War I, we manufactured mass destruction via the machine gun, the biplane, and poison gas. World War II, it took ovens to dispose of millions of corpses. Terrorism, planes crashing into buildings, martyrs strapping explosives to their bodies. Genocide in Armenia, Rwanda, Yugoslavia, Sudan, atomic warfare, tribal battles scarred the globe. Local eruptions of bloodshed, drive-by shootings, school shootings, violence comes to the neighborhood. All the while, the TV positions its cameras in such a way that we can see replay after replay, we can YouTube it, we can get online. And if we missed the actual event, don't worry. Hollywood will crank out a series. They'll make sure that you see the gore of the serial killer, that you see the sad news of the suicide. Violence and murder are a reality in our culture. And yet, due to the graphic nature of our society and the violence overload that some of us endure, so in spite of all of this, I believe that many of us could sit in judgment on those that commit that most obvious manifestation of breaking the sixth commandment, all the while missing that we too break the sixth commandment. To help us better understand the commandment, we're going to ask three questions about this commandment. We're going to ask, what does it mean to commit murder? Why is it wrong to commit murder? How can we commit murder today? We must all understand that murder, what murder is, and if it is found in our lives, we must confront it with the grace of God. So the first question is this: what does it mean to commit murder? Our text, it simply reads, "You shall not murder." Four words in our English text. There's only two in the Hebrew behind it. You could read it this way: never murder, or do not commit murder ever. There's no ambiguity in what the text is saying in regards to your participation in murder. But the prohibition of murder, it does not prohibit self-defense. In Exodus 22, verses 2 through 3, it says, "If a thief is found breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there shall be no blood guilt for him. But if the sun rises on him, there shall be blood guilt for him." And there's a sense of, as somebody's invading the home and you're trying to protect your family and you're trying to protect your goods, that you can defend yourself. But if you're waiting till the morning and then you go hunt down that one that did you wrong, it seems that vigilantism, that there's really not freedom from being considered murder. "Thou shalt not murder" does not prohibit self-defense. It does not prohibit capital punishment, because in the next chapter in Exodus 21 and the rest of Exodus, he prescribes 18 different uses for capital punishment. Earlier, when Noah left the ark, God rebooted this world and reminded him. And he said this in Genesis 9, verse 6. He said, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God is made in his own image." And God gave mankind capital punishment as protection of the image of God and man and a declaration of justice. In fact, later on in Romans, Paul reminds us, he says, "For rulers," in Romans 13, verse 4, "rulers are not a terror for good, terror to good conduct, but to bad. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoers." So do not murder does not prohibit self-defense, nor capital punishment, nor does it prohibit nations from defending themselves in war. Christians are primarily to be a people of peace. In fact, as individuals, we're exhorted to turn the other cheek. In fact, there are times that people are coming to really thwart what really is the will of God, so that Christ looks at Peter and he says, "This is not our kingdom. Lay down your swords." But there are times that it would seem that we would need to take arms against those that would do us harm. Christ had interaction with soldiers in the New Testament and really did not say anything about the necessity of an army. In fact, he praised the faithfulness of the centurion, but did not rebuke him for being a soldier. Peter was conversing with Cornelius, a soldier. And then you see John the Baptist. He's talking to some soldiers, and he's just simply telling them, be content with your wages. But when it does come to blows, Christians are not to gloat. They're not to glory in the death of others. As we look historically from an ethical standpoint, World War II is probably one of the most clear-cut examples of what can be considered a just war. The United States was attacked in a sneak attack from Japan, and then the United States declares war on Japan, and then Japan's ally Germany declares war on the United States, and we have a clear history books to tell us that what we were fighting for, and it was a protection of people's rights, it was a protection from really unjust rulers who were seeking to damage and destroy other people. And over the course of my life, I love history, specifically World War II history, and I've read probably maybe 100 books on World War II. As a child, there would be joy when an enemy ship would be sunk in the Pacific, and I'd get excited and cheer if a German division was decimated. And in some regards, that's not a bad thing. I mean, when you want your boys to win so they can come home, right? And yet, when you begin to really think about war, and you begin to think of bodies strewn over a battlefield, and when you begin to zoom out and look historically at World War II, 85 million people dead. Civilians caught in crossfires. Islanders who know nothing of what's going on. All that they know is that one force came and built an airfield, and another one keeps on blowing up that airfield. 15 million Chinese caught. 5 million Polish. Because they were the battlefield between the Russians and the Germans. 6 million Jews. The fiery deaths of those in Hiroshima and Dresden. Our hearts ought to take a breath and think about eternity and those souls. And so while the prohibition against murder is not referring to the authorized use of deadly force in self-defense or capital punishment, God is communicating that no unauthorized private person or group has the right to end human life. You see, that's really God's duty. That's really God's realm. And so this prohibition, it includes the intentional taking of someone's life. A murderer could be one that has plans and plots the demise of their enemy minutes to years in advance. It could be cold, calculated, precise methods could be the description. Both King Ahab and King David planned the death of one that stood in the way of their idol. There was an intentional, premeditated murder, and that is sin. A murderer could be somebody that just gets caught up in the heat of the moment. You're there and somebody does you wrong. Somebody offends your honor. Somebody hurts somebody you love. And with a flash of anger, you end the life of another person. It may not have had specific plans, but the heat of the moment arrived and they submitted to do their own evil impulses. This could be Cain, who was stirred against his brother. Impassioned, rash murder is sin. This commandment is a prohibition that would include the accidental and non-intentional taking of someone's life. In fact, as we begin to unfold this commandment, it would condemn those that set into motion, it would set into motion punishment for those that are negligent. You see, God's people are to so esteem and so protect the lives of those that are around them that we actually ought to look for the safety of others. That's why even in our culture, we have people that could be tried for manslaughter. It wasn't your intention to wake up and drive that car and hit them. But it still happened. And you were driving. That's why it gets even more culpable as you begin to approach that driving moment, not just with a flash of distraction and your eye was caught here, but then you pick up the phone, you begin texting, you pick up a bottle, you begin drinking. It wasn't your intention that morning to wake up and hurt somebody. And that's why, and even in the law, I was told, if you're able to make a room for you to enjoy the cool evenings, you better put a fence around it. You better put a fence so nobody can fall off. But if you don't put a fence around it, if somebody goes up on your roof and they fall off and they're killed, you're responsible. He said, if you have an ox and your ox has gored somebody, but it's never done that before, well, that's okay. That's not your fault. But if that ox continues to gore people, now you're held culpable for that. You didn't take the responsibility what is yours. This prohibition is really to include accidental, non-intentional taking of somebody's life through negligence or the accidental killing of somebody else. It really wasn't negligent. It was just, you were there when the accident happened. That's the difference between murder, manslaughter, and a pure accident. And he said, so it could be in Deuteronomy, here you are with an axe, and your neighbor's out there helping, and you go back and you pull the axe back, and the head of the axe flies off, strikes your neighbor in the head, and kills them. It wasn't your intention. You weren't negligent. You were maintaining your tools correctly. It was just an accident. While this unintentional accident is viewed as murder, he said this in really the law. He said the perpetuator is viewed differently. He's given an opportunity to go to a city of refuge to escape any vengeance that could come from somebody's in the murdered family. And yet what he does in all this is he's communicating that life matters. He's communicating that life is important. He's communicating that God is for life. In fact, if we were just to summarize what he's saying in this text, we could say it this way. You shall not murder is a prohibition against unauthorized killing through murder or manslaughter, whether premeditated intent or by negligence. The taking of life is a matter of deadly significance. In fact, as I was assigned this one at the very beginning as we were thinking through how we preach the Ten Commandments, I got this one. I thought, oh, this is going to be easy, but I've actually been very convicted. Very convicted about how I view life, how I view people, how I view other people dying. What does God think about this? So we ask the question, what is murder? We ask the second question, why is it wrong to commit murder? This answer is found in the very nature of God. It's who he is. It's found in the nature of God and who he's made mankind to be. Because God has created us, he is in control. And as the creator, he's the one that owns all things. He sets the rules. And Exodus 20, verse 3, reminds us that he is Lord over all. We could say it this way. Murder is wrong because it attacks the character of God. It attacks the fact that he's the creator, that he's really the king, and that he's the judge. It attacks the idea that all things come from him, that he is the originator and owns all things. Here in Exodus 20, verse 11, it says, for in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. Paul in Colossians, he says, for by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. You see, if you make something, it's yours, right? You design something, it's yours. That's why we have copyright laws. That's why we have trademarks. An artist, if he makes a painting, he can, at his own leisure and his own desire, he can trash the painting. The florist can set her arrangement in the window for all can enjoy. The sculptor can take his prized work of art and put it into a room that only a few can see. The owner can do whatever he wants with the possession. It would be offensive for the stranger to come in and adjust the flower vase. It would be offensive for him to take that sculpture and drag it into the public sector if that's not what the creator wanted. You see, the creator owns that which he made. In like manner, God is the creator of life. For somebody else to take it, that's offensive. Job said it this way, naked I came into the world, or naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked shall I return. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. You see, why is it so wrong to commit murder? Because it's an attack on the character of God. It attacks the fact that he's the creator. It attacks the fact that he's the king. He's the sovereign. He rules over the affairs of man. He sets up kings. He sets kings aside. He is sovereign. Right here in this passage, verse 2, he says, I am the Lord your God. I am the Lord your God. I brought you out of the hand of Egypt, out of the hand of slavery. You see, the king, the eternal king, he conquered the earthly king Pharaoh. It's God who did the miracle. God's the king. And as the king, all subjects are to live in submission to his desires. Do you know that even Paul, who was just vexed, the pressures of this world, do you ever feel the pressures of this world? Do you ever want to leave? Do you ever want to go away to your happy place? Ultimately, some of us just want to go. And Paul said, I'm betwixt. I'm in this pressure. He said, I'm hard-pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with God, but also I have a desire to stay here and be with you. And so what does he have to do? He must submit to the king. You see, murder is an attack on the character of God, that he's a creator, that he's the king, but he's the judge. You see, God is the present and future judge. He said of himself right here in this text in verse 4 and 5, he said, I am the Lord your God. Am a jealous God. He visits iniquity on the fathers of the children, of the fathers that were wicked, but then he shows his steadfast love to those that have sought his face. You see, God is the judge. Paul tells us in Romans 14, he says, we must all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. For it is written, as I live, saith the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, every tongue shall confess to me. So each of us will give an account to God. Murder is wrong, for it assumes that the creation is greater than the creator. It's an act of rebellion towards the heavenly king and forgets that God is the judge of the universe. Murder is wrong because it attacks the character of God, but murder is wrong because it ignores that man was created in the image of God. You see, at the very core of the prohibition against murder is the proclamation that mankind was made in the image of God. We are all part of the creation that most reflects who God is. That's why God told Noah in Genesis 9, verse 6, he said, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man his blood shall be shed, for God made man in his own image. You see, in the very fact that we are made in the image of God means that we are made with dignity. This dignity is expressed on how God made us, with a distinctness and with a morality, and with a value. You see, we as image bearers of God were distinct. Mankind is different from the rest of the creation. We are not plants, and we're different than the animals. We think about eternity. Death is something that mankind fears and tries to avoid. I don't think the lawn that I'm going to get ready to mow this week, I don't think that the grass is living in fear of the mower coming across. Oh no, it's going to cut me again. But we think about eternity. We are made with the capacity to think about eternity. We are made with the capacity to create. I mean, mankind has created some of the most unbelievable inventions. I was just thinking about recently, some of the greatest telescopes are getting ready to go online in the next 5 years, and some of the biggest ones are being built in Chile because the high Andy Mountains and the lack of light pollution. And there's going to be another one in Hawaii, but one of the most exciting ones is one that the European Space Agency is going to launch into space, and it's a huge telescope, satellite-based telescope. Can you imagine all the different mathematics that went into that? Physics and the calculus, and just think with me, it's and then the metallurgy and the chemistry and the bonding of metals to different heat resistance and the cold and the heat that it's going to take. But just think about all that went into that process. Can I tell you something? My dog didn't do that. The Planet of the Apes did not do that. Image bearers did that. The reason why we can create is because we bear the image of God. The reason why we think about eternity is because God is eternal. And he gives us the ability to verbalize. He gives us the ability to communicate on such a level that here I've said probably 1,000 different kinds of words already, and we're beginning to process that, and we're putting it into logical fashion, and we're thinking of it in light of our own understanding of eternity and the capacity that God has given us. Perhaps you've seen the internet sensation, little clips of a dog named Jumpy. Has anyone seen Jumpy? Okay, Jumpy is a border collie. He knows 400 commands. It's impressive, okay? It's so impressive, you've got to look it up. I mean, you're not now, stop. Some of you are reaching for phones. Jumpy, I mean, seriously, you say left, he looks left. You say right, he looks right. You say play dead, he just falls over, puts his hand, his arm. Look at me. Did you see what I just did there? His hand. He puts his arm right over his eyes, and he plays dead. I mean, he does these tricks where he runs, jumps off his owner, does a flip. I mean, he rides a wakeboard. He can walk on his hind legs. He can walk on his front legs. He can ride a scooter. He can steer a scooter down a curvy mountain path. Now, John Kopp, get off your... Don't be looking for Jumpy right now, all right? Because John Kopp's the only guy I know that can listen to a sermon and look for Jumpy all at the same time. But you want to know something? Jumpy can speak 400 words and do 30 tricks. He's probably the smartest dog we have ever known. But that's as good as it gets. 400 commands and 30 tricks. Jumpy doesn't even get jokes. What a boring life. But you do. You can think about it, and you can enjoy it, and you can laugh, and you can cry, and you can verbalize, and you can communicate with your tongue. You can communicate nonverbally. You can write. You were made in the image of God. And the image of God brings dignity, because there is a distinction between those that are in this room listening to this message and the birds that fly and the fish that swim and the dog that trots. In addition to our distinction from the rest of creation, it's played out in a distinction amongst each other. Can I tell you how amazing God is? That it's not just that he makes mankind, but he makes every single one of us different. Each one of us to reflect the glory of God in our unique way, with all of our strengths and all of our quirks. And we all got them. We're all weird. We express not only our personalities through the distinction of who we are that way, but then it also goes through the filter of gender. And God makes us distinct. But he makes us with the distinct ability and capacity to worship the one that made us. You were made in the image of God. There's a dignity to being made in the image of God. You are distinct, but then you have morality. Mankind has the ability to contemplate right from wrong. God's law is written on your heart. The oak tree does not consider that its shade is robbing the sunshine from the flowers below. The wolf has no remorse for ripping the heart out of a baby deer. But you are touched in a way of establishing what's right and wrong. It's so unique how we try to force the morality that we have as image bearers onto some animals around us. And so we have a dog. His name is Snickers. And if Snickers eats some food that he should not eat, that we left out, he's ashamed. Why? Because he likes us. He wants us to like him. But can I tell you something? He has zero remorse for eating the food. He just doesn't like hearing bad Snickers. That scares him. Isn't it funny when we say bad dog? Because he was just being dog. In fact, if we leave food out again, can I tell you what Snickers is going to do? He's going to eat, and then he's going to wait for us at the door. Because that's what dogs do. We don't like it when Snickers just starts barking. But guess what he does? He barks. You know why? Because dogs bark. We were there at the soccer field last night, and there's a dog, and he freaks out, and he's barking. And you know what? We could even see bad Snickers on that one, and it's not going to stop. Because dogs do what dogs do. They don't think about whether or not that is right or wrong, but you do because you have dignity. You're made in the image of God. You're distinct, and you have the capacity to contemplate morality. Do you see? That's why only the most psychopathic are devoid of morality. I mean, you take Adolf Hitler, who obviously things weren't working right for the man. He somehow convinces people to butcher people, and yet he's upset at Rommel, one of his generals, because Rommel put together a cadre of people who tried to assassinate him. He still made judgments of right and wrong. Why? Because even a scarred individual like Hitler was made in the image of God. There was something that God put in him that was different than any other creation. He made us with the capacity of right and wrong, but he made us to be a people of value. We are made to have this eternal special relationship with God. That's why we're distinct. That's why we can consider right and wrong. We are created with undying souls so we could enjoy his presence forever. But as the story unfolds, Adam and Eve, they chose to disobey God. They chose to walk away from God. And yet God so loved this aspect of his creation that he sends his son Jesus to die for us. The dignity that you have that results in a distinctness from other creation, the ability to consider right and wrong, that even though you as a creation and I as a creation, even though we have sinned against a holy God and we deserve his punishment, rather than squishing us, the Father sends the Son because he sees image bearers. He made Christ a little lower than the angels, and though he was crowned with glory and honor, and we see him for a little while made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone. Do you know that being made in the image of God means you're made with dignity, and there is value. Jesus Christ did not die for the angels. He did not die for dogs or apes. He died for those that were made in his image. This is why murder is wrong. This is why it's offense to God. Because murder attacks the very nature of God and rips at the image of God in all of mankind. This is why our culture is floundering. This is why they've lost the way. Because they have no foundation to answer life's most basic questions. They can't answer, where did I come from? They can't give an answer to, where am I going? What's my purpose? Why am I here? Those questions can only be answered when rightly connected to God's character and who we are before this God. But when there's a disconnect, life doesn't work. Oh, this world tries. They try something in them. Remember? They're doing this because that's how God made them. Something in them is trying to reconcile right and wrong without God. There's something in them is trying to create order without submission to God. They don't want to live in submission to the Creator and the King and the Judge. But something in them won't let them escape. And so they come up with all sorts of philosophies. So Thomas Hobbes, back in the 1600s, he wrote what was basically the social contract. He said, the way that we establish right and wrong is we as a people submit ourselves to a benevolent ruler and will do whatever that good ruler wants us to do. But that doesn't work. What happens when benevolent king is now a tyrant? What happens when Louis XIV, in his extravagance, begins building these opulent palaces and bankrupting his people? You know what happens? His great-grandson now is beheaded. That's what happens. Social contracts do not take care of the real issue. So then what society does is it says, oh, I know how we'll create right and wrong. I know how society will work better. We'll come at it from a utilitarian perspective, really an ethical pragmatism, and a statements like this. Really what the choices we should make is we want the greatest pleasure for the greatest number of people. Don't murder because we need all the workers we can get. Don't murder because life works better when people aren't murdered. murdered. But who gets to decide what good is? And who gets to decide what good is for the greatest number of people? What if some senior enjoys a good life but actually begins to rob a younger, more productive member of society? What about the Inuit tribe that takes its elderly and sends them onto the ice so that the younger can live? How is it that Hitler was able to rationalize his brutality on whole groups of people by convincing others that life would be better if we eradicated that ethnicity? You see, the world's methods don't work, or emotionalism. It's just like, look at the pain that you caused when that person's been killed. People are crying. People are hurt. But I've known people that were so burdened giving care to one that could not care for themselves that they actually had an emotional release when that one died. We readily can become calloused. Emotions don't really deal with it. Or self-governance. We just have to work together. That's what we need to do, don't we? Because it takes a village. You know, everyone just do your part. Everyone, we're just going to all work together. You know, we're going to be the model society. We're just going to pick and choose which rules are best for our society. And we're just going to all work together. But what happens when there's only one crate of food? What happens when the electricity goes out? It's like a room, and everyone's in a circle around this room, and there's 1 gallon of water left in all of Salt Lake. Somebody says, let's share. Let's all take a sip. And everything looks good until one breaks ranks. And when one runs to make a grab, hellish things break out. Oh, one will have the bottle of water when it's all over. One will at the murder of the rest. You see, this world tries to come up with all manner of ways to take care of society, all manner of means to help us to protect ourselves from each other, but they disconnect it to who God is, and they disconnect it to the image bearers that all of us are, and none of these things will keep mankind, keep them from taking the lives of others. And when you throw into it really the whole thought process that mankind is not an image bearer, that they're not distinct, that they're just an animal, they're just part of this all, this whole evolutionary process, what begins to happen is now I'm just collections of atoms, and they've been arranged in a random way. And so now time plus randomness equals mankind. How hopeless is that? How lost we are without God. That's why they can pull the plug. That's why they can scrape the womb. That's why they can feast on death and chew on brutality. But if we don't take the time to understand why they're coming at their conclusion, all we do is shout at each other. I don't like the end of your choices. And I don't like the end of your choices. And you're trying to limit my freedom. And you're trying to raise yourself against God. If we don't take the time to expose what's driving at these things, there'll never be a conversation that helps anyone. So that's why, without God, no one can answer life's most basic questions. Where did I come from? I don't know. Where am I going? Don't know. Why am I here? Don't know. I guess life is just all about me. But friend, you can answer why murder's wrong, because God is the creator. He's the creator, the sovereign. He's the judge. We are his creation. He determines life. He determines when it begins. He determines when it should end. His sovereign kingship is on display. Therefore, we must live in step with God. So how then, this is question number 3, how do we commit murder today? If murder is really the taking of one's life, and if murder is wrong because it's an assault on the character of God, and it's an assault really on what we are as image bearers of Christ, how can we commit murder? Well, we can commit murder by killing each other. It's called homicide. Homicide is the deliberate act of unlawfully slaying another. It can be perpetuated by an individual, an organization, or even a religion. In the Bible, we see some examples of murder with the hand. Joab kills Abner, or with the tongue. You speak with such prejudice that you stir up a people to go murder somebody. That's the Jews towards Jesus. It's with the pen, where David sends a death sentence for Uriah, one of his soldiers, or by plot, you've got Jezebel murdering Naboth, or by consent, Saul watching the stoning of Stephen. So we can murder by killing one another, homicide. If we were to apply it today, it would be a murderer would be taking a group of folks and marching into a village and beheading them because they're Christians. But guess what? Murder would be for a group of us to go into a village and behead people because they're Muslims. We can defend ourselves, but to simply pick a class of people, it's a man to systematically walk into a place of employment, lock and load, and start blowing people away. I really do think we should ask ourselves if we should participate in this behavior, even in a digital manner. It's murder when someone goes on a vigilante-style rampage killing. How many movies follow the revenge motif? You did me wrong, so I'm going to kill anyone remotely connected with you. Is that really the type of butchery that we should watch on the flat screen? What does God's character mean to you? We can commit murder by killing ourselves. This could be reckless endangering of our life. It's just maybe there's some of us that just, we're just the way we live life, it's all out and it's on the edge. It could also include addictions to unhealthy life-stealing habits. Is there any substance that controls you that dramatically decreases your life expectancy? That the most obvious one would be where there's scientific evidence that says if you do this, then your life will be decreased with. It's me hearing... It's grandfather dies at 55, dad dies at 74, and Will, you've got the same genetic propensity. If you are going to eat beef and deep-fried foods the rest of your life, you will decrease your life. Do you know I ought to give an account to God for what I eat? I ought to actually consider, is this the best use of what God's made me for? Am I the master and commander of my life? Or am I actually going to submit to who is in charge of my life? It's subtle suicide, isn't it? This does refer to our taking of our own life. Suicide is a sin against God, ourselves, and others. We are the perpetuator, and yet we're one of the victims. We actually cause there to be victims in our community. It leaves people in pain and despair. But King Saul and the Philippian jailer, they couldn't see an end to their game. And so King Saul falls on his sword. The Philippian jailer grabs his sword only for Paul to intervene. And I'm sure that in our church, and I'm sure it, because even the state of Utah hovers in the top 10 of really suicides per capita in the nation. There are some of us in this room that we struggle with suicidal tendencies. Can I tell you? It's real. It's dark. We don't see a way out. Please, though it makes no sense when you're feeling this, do call somebody. You will not be mocked by a pastor if you call and say, I just want to die. What we'll do is we'll help and find help for you. In fact, it may be that there's some of you that you wouldn't pull the trigger, but you would just live life in such a way that you would mope your way into the grave. Oh, friend, fight for joy. Believe the promises of God. Hold on to Jesus, because I have a question. What else do you have? Oh, friend, you are an image bearer. You were made with dignity. You are different than the animals. Oh, friend, you can contemplate right and wrong. Oh, friend, you have value. Jesus died for you. He didn't die for the animals. He didn't even die for the angels. He died for you. Stop believing the lies that ricochet around your brain. It's so amazing how the whole concept of murder and how deceptive the liar from the beginning, how Satan lied. He lied to us. He said, you'll be like gods. You'll live forever. And he forced us to drink that cup of death. He's the murderer from the beginning. And the murderer drips into some of our brains. And maybe there was somebody in passion who grabbed somebody and throttled them and killed them and took their life. But it doesn't end there, does it? No, now Satan camps out on the shoulder and he says, you're not worthy. You're not worthy of anything. You die. You pull the trigger. You go for it. Can I tell you? You were made in the image of God. Stop believing satanic lies. Believe truth. Hold on to the promises of God. Where else can you go? There's no answers outside of the character of God. The fact that he's our creator who made us in his image. We commit murder by killing others. We commit murder by killing ourselves. We can commit murder by killing the unborn and the unwanted. 54 million abortions since 1973 in our country. Life begins at conception. When the seed fertilizes the egg, amazing things unfold. 22 days, the heart begins to beat. Brain waves detectable at 6 weeks. The baby feels pain at 12 weeks. For you were formed in my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there were none of them yet. The question of abortion is not primarily a scientific question. Is the baby alive? It's a question of morality. Who has the right to terminate the life? That's the question. If our society goes far enough down the path, the question is not if the baby's alive. The question is who has the right. That's why the Bible in 38 states have laws regarding the death of a child in the womb. That's why in Exodus it says when two men are fighting in Exodus 21 and one hits a pregnant woman so that the child comes out. If there's no harm, then all is good. That the man that struck the woman will pay a fine. But if there is harm, then you'll pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound. In the state of Utah, it declares, this is the law, I just read on it, 38 states have laws like this. It says that a person commits criminal homicide if the person unintentionally, knowingly, recklessly causes the death of another human being, including an unborn child at any stage of its development. An interesting passage is when Mary, the mother of Jesus, meets with her cousin Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist. Listen to Luke 1. It says, in those days, Mary entered in the house of Zechariah and greeted Elizabeth. And when Elizabeth heard the greeting of Mary, the baby leaped in her womb, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit. And she exclaimed with a loud cry, blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb. And why is this granted to me, that the mother of my Lord should come to me? For behold, when the sound of your greeting came to my ears, the baby in my womb leaped for joy. At what point was that child the Son of God? At what point could Mary have aborted and had no impact on the redemptive plan of man? This is not really a scientific question, but a moral one. If someone besides God chooses who's born and who dies, if someone besides God gets that choice, then the unraveling of society begins. The termination of the feeble, the weak, and the elderly is now put on the table. If the value of life is based on pragmatism or the value of life and not the character of God and the image that he stamped on every human being, then you can understand why this culture allows for the termination of the unborn or the unwanted. I do believe that it's easy for some Christians to become so impassioned that they fail to have constructive communication, that you don't sit down and say, can we just look at the text? Can we just think about this in a kind manner? And what can happen is now it becomes such an impassioned issue that some people over here find a case study and they say, but you don't understand. You've never been pregnant. You don't understand because, and then this one over here says, but you aren't reading the Bible, but you aren't living in submission. And what happens is there's overshoot. If we don't take the time to understand, why is it that they're thinking this way? You want to know why? because at the core, there's not a connection between the character of God and the image of God that every human has. But when we begin to understand that, you can endure other people's diatribes. You can endure other people's anger. And you can listen because at the core, they're saying, but you're saying I'm not in control. You're saying that I'm not in control of this. Let me just say a couple things. I do not want to add false guilt to somebody that was in an emergency room trying to make a split decision between the life of a mother and a baby. I do not want to add more guilt on somebody that perhaps has made choices in this arena. I don't want to add false guilt to somebody who was in a decision-making process of somebody with no brain, detectable brain waves and the continued life support and the decisions that they made. But if there's someone here that does have guilt when you think of things like this, I want you to know that there is grace and that we love you. And society is of such that so many of us are told that it's really all about us. And some of us make decisions. Can we really taste grace here? I mean, seriously, where we love? I think sometimes we get really angry at people's voting choices. And we totally miss the soul. Oh, I know where I vote on this. I do. I know where I am. But it's so much deeper than just checking a box. There's hurting people. And all of a sudden, you don't even get a chance to even love this person who just in their own heart is struggling because they know in their heart they were stamped with the image of God. In their heart, there's that dignity. In their life, they know they're distinct from, they're not an animal. It's just not an animal. That's a person. They know in their heart there's right and wrong. And in their heart, there's value that Jesus would die for me when I don't deserve it. They know this, and yet they can't taste it because some of us are shouting so loud that all they see is your angry face. And they don't taste grace. We commit murder by taking other people's lives. We commit murder by taking our own life. We commit murder by taking the lives of the unborn or the weak, but we can commit murder by thinking or expressing our anger and hatred. I want to remind you how we started. He said, due to the graphic nature of our society, many of us sit in judgment of others while breaking the sixth commandment ourselves. Matthew 5, verse 20, Jesus addressed this type of Pharisaism. You see, for somebody to sit here and point their finger at somebody that's committed physical murder, for somebody to point at somebody who's committed suicide, for somebody to point at somebody else and judge them is really a Pharisaicism, because he said this, he said in Matthew 5, he says, I will tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter into the kingdom of heaven. He said, you've heard that it was said of those old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable of judgment. He says, so here you sit on judgment of murderers, but he says, whoever insults his brother, or in many translations it's the word raka. It's just an Arabic idiomatic, it's just an expression. It's really saying, it's just an insult. It's like, you idiot. It's like, you stupid idiot. He says, you do that with anger, you're liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, a judgment of character, will be liable to the hell of fire. For you have this offering, your gift at the altar. Remember that you have a brother that is against you. Leave your gift there at the altar and go and be reconciled to your brother and then offer your gift. You see, whoever insults his brother with this raka type language, it's that stupid idiot, moron, boneheaded. Those are mild expressions. It's usually, it's a little bit steeper usually, isn't it? I can't even say them right now, can I? And he says, you do that, you're trashing the character of God, and you're attacking the image bearing that every human does. Do you know what this passage does? It just brings it down to home. Where here we are, we sit in judgment of this one and sit in judgment of that one. And he says, no, here you are. You're angry. You're mad. So you're going to go ahead and you're going to call that person a fool. And you're going to judge them because you don't even know what's going on in their life. And you don't even know the whole circumstance. And he says, you're going to rip them to shreds. You're going to gossip. It's easy to ruin someone's day with a word. You know what happened to me? Just 2 days ago, guys, I had one conversation and somebody said something in such a way, I went back to study on this passage of scripture and and it took me a full 45 minutes to get back on study. Their word ruined 45 minutes. And you know what happened? It wasn't just that they ruined 45 minutes. I began to do this passage to them. Oh, yeah? Well, you're an idiot. And he says, every time there's those expressions of anger, guess what? You are attacking the character of God. You're trashing the image of God in every person. It's easy to ruin someone's day with a word. It's easy to ruin someone's life with gossip, tale-bearing. Righteous anger is hard to come by. Unrighteous anger is easy to dispense. Unrighteous anger is anger directed to the wrong person. I don't know about you, but those of you that are married, have you ever been hurt or angry at something away from home, but you brought that anger into home? Have you ever snapped at somebody you love because somebody else hurt you? Unrighteous anger is anger motivated for the wrong reason. I find that I get mad when my idol gets messed with. I wanted to see something. I wanted to go something. You got in the way of my idol, and so now I'm mad. Or unrighteous anger is disproportionate to the offense. So have you ever realized how many things we're angry about that really aren't a big deal? You spilled the milk! Really? Really? You are 5 minutes late. Raka. Fool. Pharisee. We judge people, don't we? You thought evil about anybody? You judge somebody because of what they've done in life? Pharisees. We're all guilty, aren't we? Can I tell you? I can't keep up. I can't keep up. I'm speaking and confessing. Do you have fits of rage? There's some of you, like the Pharisees, you're whited like a whited sepulcher, but inside are bones and corruption. Do you have lists of people that you wish would just disappear? Do you fantasize about telling people off? Do you swear at people in your head? Are you always having problems with everybody else? Have you considered it might be you? What's easier, to make a list of people that bring you joy or to make a list of people that frustrate you? Who are you mad at right now? Who could walk in right here if you were solo sitting here? Somebody walks in and you would feel anger stirred. Be angry, sin not. Do not let the sun go down upon your wrath. Everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. And do you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him? Whoever is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who is hasty in temper exalts folly. Whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and whoever rules a spirit than he who takes a city. Know this, my beloved brothers. Let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. He said, you're at the altar with your gift, and all of a sudden you remember one that you have an ought with. He says, leave your gift and go be reconciled. Do you need to go say sorry to a spouse? Do you need to say sorry to a coworker? Do you need to be reconciled with some other church member? Is there some brother or sister in this assembly that you find yourself angry with? We commit murder with our words and our angry thoughts, but then last, we have all participated in the murder of Jesus. Our guilt is clear. Every one of us has sinned against God. I think that every single one of us are guilty of murder somehow, somewhere in our life. We've all sinned against God. Our despising His character, the ignoring of the image of God and man is affront to His great name. Our sin demands death. Jesus, God the Son, became death for us. He's the one that absorbs all anger. If you were there at the crucifixion, you would have been traumatized by the brutality and the anger of man towards God. If Jesus Christ really was guilty of the sin that He was, why could they not have had a clean, quick execution? Why did they choose crucifixion? Why did they choose to whip Him? Why did they choose to spit on Him? Why did they choose to slap Him and rip at Him and tear at His flesh? Do you know why? Because they hate Him. They wanted Him to die a slow, brutal, long, torturous death. This was not justice. This had nothing to do with mercy. It had everything to do with anger. And we vicariously were there because of our sin. Jesus Christ died. Because of our sin, Jesus Christ shed His blood. And we too are guilty of murder at the most base sense when it comes to the murder of Jesus Christ. And as we were spitting our anger at Christ, God pours out His wrath on God, on Christ. And like a freight train on the tracks of time, the Father's wrath headed towards sinner is met by the open arms of Jesus on the cross. And in this is love, not that we loved God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the satisfier of the wrath of God. Jesus died on the cross so we could be at peace with God. Here we are. We deserve whatever brutality comes because we've broken His commandment of murder, and yet Jesus dies for us, so that we can forgive others because God, through Christ, has forgiven us. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you with all malice. Be kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God, for Christ's sake, hath forgiven you. Davy was 5 years old, and his dad, who was very depressive, called him in. He said, "Reach under my covers, Davy. Grab my hand, Davy. Squeeze my hand, Davy." And as my grandfather squeezes his father's hand, my great-grandfather squeezes the trigger on a pistol and commits suicide. Didn't know that, but my grandfather did not know love. Very driven man. Very angry man. He comes to live with us when he was 84 years old, and angry grandpa starts making angry grandson. He gives $20 for birthday and $20 for Christmas, but there's no joy. And I am thinking thoughts like, "I hate you." And I'm thinking thoughts like, "You aren't a grandpa. You don't even care." God does a miracle. And at 86, my blind, going blind grandpa, listening to 9 months worth of the New Testament, puts his faith and trust in Jesus Christ. And things start to change. Because all of us without God are murderers. But through Christ, we can be reconciled. And this man starts changing. And all of a sudden, skeletons start falling out of the closet like only can happen in a real Christian's life. And now he's got the pastor over and he says, "Did I kill him?" 81 years believing he is responsible for killing his father. "Did I kill him?" "No, David. No. And the joy in this man's life and the joy that God begins to work in my life, and now he's 88 and he's dying. And I'm the one that's got to spend the night with him. He's got prostate cancer. and I got to help him change his diapers. And one night, when this blind man is stumbling around a bathroom and his 18-year-old grandson is assisting, David, Grandpa, says, "Will, I want you to know I love you. Grandpa, I love you too. I really, really do." This world doesn't know how to be reconciled to God because they don't understand his character and they don't understand how we were made in the image of God. We were made distinct. We aren't just animals to pick and choose what we want to do. We actually can contemplate right and wrong. We were made of value. That's why the Father sent the Son to be the Savior of the world.